Welcome to Milkmaids Podcast, the unconventional homesteading podcast. I'm Stephanie from Wyoming.
And I'm Tara from Montana. Join us each week as we take a deep dive into an inclusive homesteading topic from canning, dairy animals, gardening, animal husbandry, and everything in between.
Hey, Tara.
Hello.
Hello, how's it going?
Good.
Good.
We pretend that we haven't talked for 15 minutes already.
I know. And by we today, you really just listened to me go on 300 miles an hour.
I validated your feelings.
Brian called, so that was good.
We got that out of the way early.
Right. He normally calls mid-session.
Yes. Session.
At least once.
Good. Off to a good start.
Who are we shouting out this week?
Our shout out this week goes to Willow Lane Hat Co., and they were founded in 2018. So Willow Lane Hat Co. was founded on the basis of love, a desire to connect to their Texas roots, and wanting to provide beautifully crafted hats and accessories. The founders, Amy and Kate, a mother and daughter team, wanted to be able to work from home and provide care for a special member of their family, Beau. Beau was born with cystic fibrosis and was diagnosed with diabetes. They feel really passionately about being there for Beau, and they also wanted to be able to take charge on something they feel very passionately about, quality made hats. What I enjoy about Willow Lane Hat Co. is that they aren't just there to sell you a beautiful hat, and they are so beautiful. You can find really amazing hats there. But they also feel passionately about providing a platform to speak about cystic fibrosis and share their journey with Beau. On their website, they do provide a few ways for you to be able to donate to help with cystic fibrosis. So I just suggest you give them a look. And if it wasn't enough, they also provide videos on proper care of your hats, which sometimes I felt like when I wore cowboy hats a lot, I just was like, I don't know how to take care of this. And mm-hmm. I would try to learn. And that was before YouTube videos. But
yeah, but it is important, especially when you buy quality. It's like when you buy a wool item too, you know what I mean? You spend the money on it, you want to take care of it, and there are specific ways to do so.
Yeah, and I like that where you buy the hat, you can get the information from.
Yes, especially in video form. So easy.
Yes. And they do have blogs on the history and meanings behind a lot of styles of hats, which I find interesting because I do love the history of things like that.
You do.
And you can check them out at willowlanehats.com, and please look at what they have to offer. I really like the Stetson Night Sky Rancher hat, and that hat is a dark black, and it looks like it has stars around the brim, and it's just a really cool statement piece.
And they do have a lot other than just hats, too.
Yeah.
Leather pieces, and they got a lot. It's pretty cool. Yeah. So if you want to ask us a question, reach out to us, send us a shout out, tell us about a shout out you purchased from. That'd be awesome. milkmaidspodcast@gmail.com. You can catch us at Facebook or Instagram at Milkmaids Podcast.
Cool. Do all those things. Don't forget to leave us a review.
Yes, I always forget that part, mainly because I mess it up every time.
Review, rate, subscribe.
Rescribe. Podcast business, I posted it too, but I'm going to say it on here as well, that I did do videos on the on-farm milk testing. So you can find those if you watch that or if you listen to that episode on milk testing and you want a visual component to it, look on Instagram under highlights and there's a category that says milk testing.
Yes.
Do you have a New Year's resolution?
No. I don't have time to make one. What about you? Are you a New Year's resolution type person?
No, I've never made them on account of all of the popular ones. Right? Eating right or losing weight or whatever. I don't just not, it doesn't apply to me. I don't bother with that nonsense. And then the other stuff, it's I don't like setting myself up for failure.
Right.
And I don't like accountability.
You kind of need that.
I did see there was there's this guy, I don't even know who he is or I'd shout out or whatever, but on TikTok that shows up in my For You page all the time, but he was saying about how don't make some sort of big sweeping, I'll lose 12 pounds by this date or what have you. Make generalized goals that if you do it once in a year, your life will be better for it. Right.
Yeah.
If you set it for once a week and you only make it 2 weeks, great. As long as it's still
something.
Right? If I say I'm going to eat healthy all year and I eat healthy for a week and then not the rest of the year, did it really matter?
Right.
Maybe not, right? But so one of his, he had a couple of really good suggestions, but one was to handle something annoying once a week or fix something annoying once a week.
Oh, that's a good one.
So like his example was like the handle's loose on your cabinet door. Just pick up the screwdriver and tighten it up, or like clean out that one little junk drawer, or just one little annoyance. Handle one annoyance a week, which has fit really well into my like panic nesting I'm doing right now.
Yeah.
I'm like cleaning everything and organizing everything like a busy little beaver. So anyways, I mean, like, is that a resolution? No, but I was like, you know, that's kind of a cool thought.
Yeah.
Do something that, but that none of that's farm related.
Mine was making butter. That's annoying.
That's
so
annoying.
Whose idea was this?
Butter is annoying.
So annoying.
It's so much less annoying when you get the butter churn. I will say that. But
my
it's
ears
still,
were like hurting today.
I can't do that food processor because of that. Is that what you use?
Yes.
You use KitchenAid?
No, I use the food processor.
It works so effectively, but you need to like put it at the opposite end of your property when you're doing it.
Seriously, like the next county over knows that I'm making butter. And it's not like you just get to run it for like 3 seconds.
No, it's like 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's probably not great for your food processor either to do that.
Or your
bunch.
Ears.
Or that. You know, I have my priorities. You have yours.
My body and my ears. Kind of need those.
Right. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. But your New Year's resolution is to buy a butter churn. Butter churn. That's
I just don't want more stuff, though. Like, that's the whole thing. Having more stuff is so annoying to me.
Then throw away your food processor.
Yeah, I'm about to. I wanted it to break today. I wanted that thing to break.
Oh, my gosh.
Anyway. Oh, well, I guess we'll just go right into farm updates.
Speaking of butter.
I made butter today. Yogurt, cream cheese, and I dumped a whole bunch of milk out to the pigs. So.
Wow.
Yeah. I feel accomplished.
I'm proud of you for doing all that and still having milk left over.
Yeah. I have a lot of milk left over, and I just skimmed the top of the milk off, like the cream off of it, and then I just dumped the skimmed milk to the pigs because I do not have time to make a billion cheeses, nor am I good at it, so what is the point?
Well, most cheeses are better with the cream anyways.
Yeah, for sure.
That's what we've kind of discovered. Yeah, we don't do a lot with just straight skimmed milk either.
No, you can do yogurt. I just like... A full
I like
fat.
It creamier, though.
Yeah, yeah, I like a full fat one. And then you can do mozzarella with skimmed milk. I used to do it all the time last year when I was more retentive about it, I guess.
Yeah.
But now I'm just like, I don't care. I just need it out of my life. I have so much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just realized my morning milk is still in the freezer.
Do you need to go get it?
Cool. Oh, it's probably frozen by now anyways. It's new. Or it's almost two.
Live updates.
It's not
going to
get any more frozen.
Your Alexa?
No. No, because I take my kid out with me to the barn, which we've got this like amazing little playroom set up for her, which is really cool. We're turning her into a giant diva. But no, I had like, you should see me migrating my ass back from the barn or to the barn or whatever.
Yeah.
She's like shed half of her clothes by then. So I've got those in one arm. I've got the potty because we have to take her little her little training potty. I've got the sled, which she rides there but doesn't ever ride back.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've got a whole grocery sack deal of blankets and toys and snacks or whatever that
you
come back
need
and forth.
A divorce cart.
And I've got a whole other human I'm carrying too.
Yeah, that too.
I can't set a timer because I've got my hands full, which is stupid.
You take your phone out there. All you have to do is be like, hey.
I should do Siri on it.
Yeah.
As opposed to Alexa. I used to do all my milk. I'd just carry it and bring it in here into the house and do it in the freezer here. And so then I would just say right off the bat there. But anyhow. So yeah, that happened.
Happened.
I'm just realizing we were actually talking about something completely else before I had that epiphany. So moving on.
How many gallons are you getting a day?
Like probably between 5 and 6.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
And you're still milking twice a day?
Yeah.
Wow.
But 5 or 6 a day, not twice.
No. Yeah.
Yeah. In the morning, we usually get like 3, 3.5. And at night, we usually get 2, 2.5, depending.
That's amazing.
And we cut off. Well, yeah, it really is amazing. And it also blows me away how surprisingly well we keep up on it sometimes.
Yeah.
Brian's doing multiple batches of like 4-gallon recipes of cheese.
Yeah.
And like, I think this last weekend he used 4, 4, and 2. So it's like 10 gallons.
That's amazing.
And then I've done a whole bunch of yogurt. I'm on this mission to make my yogurt taste like the Noosa brand yogurt.
It's so good.
It's going well until you don't read labels on certain things that are supposed to go into the fridge. Had this syrup. I pulled it out of the pantry. I dumped it into the yogurt. I mixed up this whole yogurt. I fed my baby a bunch of it. I ate a bunch of it. Pregnant lady ate a bunch of it. And as I was going to put the syrup back, I noticed there's mold on the top of the syrup. So we haven't died yet. Public service announcement. Apparently you need to refrigerate syrup.
Yes, you do.
So,
but now we know that.
The more you know.
Yeah. Rainbow.
Idiot. Anyway, so yeah, it seems like a lot of milk. Also, I have no idea how I'd go back to a mini now.
No, I know.
It's like the strangest thing, because there would be times with the mini I'd be drowning in milk.
I know.
And there'd be times where I'd be out, you know what I mean, and be frustrated that I only had a mini and not a full size. And
right.
Yeah, we'll see. And then we've talked about how, you know, what we do waste, we do wish we had pigs.
Exactly. But there's no balance with it, really. No matter how you swing it.
No, and we just don't. Yeah. We've got to get set up completely differently to do pigs in the winter here, which it's maybe so we cool. will someday, but yeah. So anyways, speaking of butter, bread.
What do you put butter on? Yeah. Well, you ruined that for me.
Bread.
Bread.
Sorry.
It's okay.
Bread. So bread's our main topic. This is an interesting one as far as the direction. I feel like we say that probably more than we should. Direction I thought it was going to go, or not sure, and how it actually ended up. So.
Right.
But first, the history.
All the history was gathered from a great article entitled The History of Bread from Ancient Flatbread to Sliced Bread by Gerard Paul on the website manyeats.com. That will be in our show notes as well. The history of bread making and consumption actually predates farming of grains, which I had no idea. Did you know about that?
Yeah, that's interesting.
It makes sense.
It does.
Because we were once mostly, or I guess all, hunters and foragers.
Right.
So grains can be foraged, but it never crossed my mind that that's what we were doing before.
It's interesting because I don't think if people think of like wheat as being wild ever.
Right. But or it like, was.
Yeah, we have wild oats that grow here, you know, that I didn't know existed. So, but yeah, all those things started somewhere.
Right.
Yeah.
And grains in the wild were utilized for bread making, were utilized for bread making at least 22,000 years ago, according to archaeological sites discovered in Israel at what was thought to be a hunter-gatherer community. And what they discovered in this hunter-gatherer community were items like crude fireplaces with evidence of over 20 different types of grain.
Wow.
That's amazing. And they found out that these people were actually sorting, grinding, and making flour.
That's so cool.
It really is. And this predates farming as we know it. That's so amazing. And the first evidence of any sort of use of farmed grains happened in the area known as the Fertile Crescent. Do you know what the Fertile Crescent is, Stephanie?
I do. Yeah.
Oh, I did not before I started researching this.
No, I don't know why I learned that. Like, it was just maybe like some relic of high school knowledge or something. But then I'm cheating. I'll mention it later in the episode. But I just recently watched a thing that talked about that. So,
yeah. So the Fertile Crescent is actually, it's like a C-shaped area that spans across Iraq, Syria, Palestine, Israel, Jordan, and Egypt. And this is like where the birthplace of farming really took off. And crops were actively being cultivated here first. Like, it's the first evidence that people got together and started growing and utilizing animals in a way that resembles farming today.
Yeah.
That being said, these breads were more of a flatbread, and they only got a few centimeters tall compared to like what we know as giant loaves of bread today. So if you think of bread, it's not that they were eating back in the day. Some breads were put under ashes, while over time people started to develop their own large ovens in order to make their versions of breads. And these early bread ovens were like domes, kind of what a fancy pizza oven looks like. It's really neat to see. And that they were able to last throughout history.
There's, I think parts of areas of that country still use ovens similarly.
Right. And they work so well.
Yeah.
The Egyptians were really mastering the art, and thanks to their trades with the Greeks, were able to export bread. And Egyptians are largely why yeast fermented breads were able to become so popular, they really did master it, and they have a huge hand in making that what we know as bread today. And through 300 to 150 BCE, the Roman Empire had a boom in bread making, and many were mastering the art, along with making it a well-respected occupation, because prior to this, it wasn't really a respected occupation, sadly. But after that,
people, that's interesting,
like, mastered this art, and you know how you would be a blacksmith and have an apprentice? So bread makers were the same.
Yeah, which rightfully so.
Right. It is an art for sure. At the same time, Greeks were making their own version of lighter breads that were treasured due to their lack of dark colors. So the Greeks really treasured light colored breads compared to dark breads. So they became, I feel, the way I think of it is like a wine connoisseur who smells it and is like, oh, this is aged perfectly. They just had a preference for lighter colored bread. I don't know why that stuck out to me, but it did.
Well, I think I brought this up as like a potential episode idea. The colors of food and why they are what they are is often not nature driven and is fascinating.
Yes.
And there's a lot of things where people have a preference towards a specific color on a food item. And it's like, how in the heck?
Right. Psychology of it is interesting.
It's really interesting. Yeah.
Later on in history, during the Middle Ages, the wealthy had the most access to bread and would go so far as to use only bread as plates for all of their meals. Like, that's, you know, cool. You were rich when you were using bread plates for bread everything. Plates. Bread plates.
I love that.
Bring bread plates back.
Right? Well, like, bread bowls are so trendy.
Panera. You know what I mean? Right. Yeah, Panera bread. Oh, so that's where they got it. Grains were so vital to the way of life in Europe that mills specifically designed for milling grains were common. And these mills were called grist mills. And they could just be out and about. If you were walking down the street, you'd come across one. And then you'd walk a little bit further and you'd come across another one. That's how common they were. But it wasn't until 1782 that an American inventor was able to design a fully automated flour mill, which cut down manual labor significantly. And by 1927, the American inventor Otto Frederick Rowade, if I said that wrong, I apologize, Otto. I don't think he's alive, but
I love the name Otto.
Otto is a good one.
Brian vetoed it.
Oh, Brian.
I know.
So he created the first commercial bread slicing operation. Otto did, not Brian. And this is how most consumers know bread today, but it wasn't Otto that made this popular. It was actually the company Wonder Bread that made this popular, because they were able to develop a system that sliced bread better, and then they got it out on the market faster.
So why bread, right? Like, why this episode even? Because it's strange compared to our normal episodes, I would say. However, I feel like during the wintertime we do a little bit more kitchen-based homesteading talk.
Yeah.
So here we are. It's the winter. It is the winter. So the idea of homesteading, right? It's based on the concept of self-sufficiency or on a reconnection with our food that's been so lost throughout the generations, right? And while bread's just one of those components, it's a huge part of most of our lives. This is not a super gluten-free friendly episode. That applies to you. You know, there's a ton of options out there, but for those of us who are not gluten intolerant, bread is in our lives in ways that can surprise you sometimes, even if you think you don't eat a lot of bread. And I know for me, like, I started baking bread with my great grandmother when I was a child. We moved near her when I was about 9, and she had me like right in the kitchen with her, and she absolutely ignited my passion then and there. And I haven't stopped baking since. It's truly a way that I get to feel connected to her in particular. And when I'm kneading, I remember her teaching me, like, this is exactly what it's supposed to feel like, because that's so much of bread.
Yeah.
And there's just something about bread that's so, like, ancestral and romantic, I think. But I think everybody can tap into that. I obviously have a very personal experience with it. But I think people can grasp that no matter their background. It may be a very long ways back that any of their generations of family members ever made bread. But if you haven't made bread before or aren't a fan of baking, know that there's breads for every level of baker and every timeline. So just get ready to jump in. You don't have to jump in with something super complicated right off the bat either.
So types of bread. In researching this episode, it was like really hard to figure out exactly which way to take it. Detailed on one type, overview, 101 style, or bread in general. As we looked around, it became quickly apparent, what is bread even?
What even is bread?
What is bread? Bread? What are you? So by definition, bread is a food made of flour, water, and yeast, or another leavening agent, and it's mixed together and baked. Leavening is the air in the dough that causes the bread to rise. And a leavening agent is just an ingredient that causes air to be introduced. And how they each do that is a little different. There are several types of leavening agents out there. Yeast, baking powder, baking soda, even egg whites. So there's lots of options. While they all work well to introduce air to the dough, they all do this slightly differently. But let's back up first and talk a little bit about the science of bread.
Yeah, and we have to mention this show on Netflix. No affiliation, unfortunately.
TM.
Right? It's called Cooked. It's fascinating. It's actually a four-part series. They're absolutely all worth watching. But the one titled Air is fascinating and super fitting for this episode, as it's all about bread in particular. And they have like wonderful cultural information on there as well as the science, as well as just like good eating bread in general. It's a really beautiful show. So if you are interested in this further, that's a good place to go too. It's a wonderful Perfect. Use of an hour of your time. So a lot of this is kind of repeated in that show too. But anyway, so for the bread science, we're going to jump in. For our purposes here, we're going to talk about flour made from wheat. Again, there's 100 other types of flour you can use and non-flour items as well, but we're starting there. So wheat flour contains a pair of proteins. I should have looked this up. Gliadin and glutenin. So when you add water or a liquid of any sort and mix, the two combine to form gluten. And gluten's a term that we're all familiar with, as it is very popular in the food world right now.
Yeah, it's a hot word right now.
It's a hot take.
Yeah.
Gluten in general. So gluten forms naturally, but the more kneading and manipulation you do, it forms into longer and stronger strands. And these strands provide a scaffolding of sorts that gives the bread its texture that we know. The texture then is all done via the air. And the air pockets that you know to exist in the bread are just gases that are pushed up against these strands and structures of the gluten. And then that raises, right? Like literally like a bounce house. Think of that. So without the structure of gluten to support and trap the gases, the bread just tends to fall on the heavy side, dense, really dense bread, not that soft, fluffy stuff that we're used to, which is why gluten-free bread has added challenges, because you don't have that scaffolding in there. So where does all this air and gas come from? Yeast, primarily. So again, there's other ways to make bread. We'll get there. Let's talk about yeast for a little while. So yeast is a one-celled fungi, which is really, the more you, and maybe it's just because I'm a biology nerd, the more you think about the fact that these things are alive is amazing. So some enzymes in yeast break down long chains of starches into glucose molecules, and other enzymes use the glucose to process and produce CO2 and ethanol. So this is really just a type of fermentation, just on a faster scale than we typically think of. And there are side reactions too, and other things going on with the yeast, which contribute to the flavor of yeasted bread. And without getting too nerdy, essentially there's acids, esters, and alcohols, chemically not booze, produced as well. And all of those add flavor. So one cool thing about yeast is that us humans have raised and domesticated yeast, which again is just mind blowing. But we've captured it, bred it to do exactly what we want it to do, which is raise the dough and do it quickly. Just pretty.
You can say you have a pet.
Yeah. Think about like domesticating yeast. Like this pen of yeast, that bowl, you know what I mean?
Right. Like, put that on your resume. Like, I'm a yeast domesticator. I am here for it. I think it's great.
It's insane. Like,
it is.
Yeah. And yeast can come from all sorts of places, obviously. But the fact that you can just go buy it at the store in a jar.
Wild.
And have paid no thought to where this came from or how it got in the jar.
Right.
Like, that's the... If you're not fascinated by stuff that like that, homesteading probably has a different meaning to you than it does to me. But things like that, that connection with your food. It's just like, wait a minute, how did this
actually...
I like
to think about, like, how would I get yeast if it wasn't readily available?
No, I do the same thing, too.
Yeah.
Like, all last winter, I went through my pantry and, like, I picked a product that was purchased in there and then learned how to make it. Like, so I made a gazillion crackers, right?
Right. Just... Yeah, you were on a cracker kick.
Like things like that, that it was like, how do you, yeah, if you couldn't go run to the store really quick, how would you acquire this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeast can come from the air, spoiler alert, for a different episode.
Yeah.
But That's the answer to that question.
Good. So types of yeast breads. There's lean. Lean breads are essentially water, yeast, flour, and salt. Usually not much more goes into them. And then they tend to produce like a crunchier crusted bread. Like, so think baguettes or ciabatta breads, etc. Enriched breads. These breads contain a higher percentage of fats, milk, eggs, butter, etc. And they tend to be sweeter in flavor and softer in texture and crust. Sandwich bread, cinnamon rolls, etc. Fat does a couple of things in the bread. First, it coats and shortens the gluten strands, which is mostly responsible for that soft texture. It also slows down the yeast activity, which means a longer rise time is usually crucial. Sometimes recipes will ask that you incorporate and knead dough prior to adding most of the fats. This forms the gluten prior to adding the inhibitor, but that's only for some breads, and your recipe will tell you to do so if that is the case.
So how to actually make a yeasted bread, right? So the first thing you're going to come across in a yeasted bread recipe is it's going to typically call for you to proof your yeast. I have the wildly unpopular opinion that you don't need to do that.
Mine's old.
Huh?
My yeast is really old, so I always proof it.
Unless you have old yeast, yeah. Because, yeah, the reason for proving it is to make sure that it's working.
Yeah.
So in my opinion, if you have fresh yeast and you haven't had a problem with it, just go for it. It saves you a little time. But there are exceptions to that too. Just follow directions until you get a handle on what you're doing.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, here's how you proof your yeast. So, and your recipe will, if it wants you to prove the yeast, it's going to tell you more than just prove the yeast. It'll tell you how to do it specifically. So
yes,
essentially you're going to take a portion or potentially all of the liquid, depending, usually water in the recipe, and warm it up to about 110 degrees. Add a little bit of sugar, add your yeast, let it rehydrate on the surface for a few minutes, and then stir it in. And now you'll cover it, set it aside for like 5 to 10 minutes. And at the end, you'll have a frothy, foamy mixture. So this is essentially just proof of life in your yeast. If you don't have foam, then something happened to your yeast. It's most likely dead, and you'll need to start over with different yeast entirely, because chances are good if that batch didn't go well, your whole jar's dead. So while I don't tend to proof my yeasts, in all of my years of baking, I've never had a yeast fail. I also bake bread obsessively, so my yeast never gets very old. There's still lessons to be learned about the process in general, on the behavior of yeast through this experiment of proofing it. So let's talk about that. So step one is to warm the liquid. Why do we do that? Well, yeast reacts quicker at a warmer temperature. Most organisms do. 110 is ideal. Too hot and you'll kill some of the yeast, and too cold and the yeast, you won't kill it necessarily, but it does slow down the reaction time, which means that you'll need a longer rise to get the same result. The next step calls for the addition of sugar. And remember back to the way that yeast works. So part of the enzymes in the yeast are designed to harvest glucose from the starches so that other parts of the enzyme can use the glucose molecules to produce CO2. So by adding a little bit of sugar, you're essentially giving it that glucose so it can start working immediately and get to producing CO2 immediately. There's less of a delay there while it works to produce its own glucose. So we can take this knowledge and understand better how yeast is working in our breads, and that in turn will help our breads work out well. So if you're making a lean bread, the directions are quite simple. Into a large mixing bowl, pour your flour. Unless you're very confident in your recipe, it's best to add like half of your flour at first. Onto one side of the bowl, add your yeast. Onto the other side of your bowl, add your salt. Or you do not want the yeast and the salt to touch. Salt undiluted like that can inhibit and kill your yeast. So after you have that all in a bowl, you're going to add your warm water and get to mixing. So you're going to mix that until it's well combined. You can either do this with a mixer or by hand. If you're using a mixer, be sure to use a dough hook. Most KitchenAids come with one. If you are making an enriched bread, the one with the fat, it will be more important to follow the recipe exactly as far as when and how to add the ingredients. Proving the yeast is definitely more important in enriched doughs too, because as Tara said, like, it can give your yeast the upper hand before you've even added all the fat to slow it down. So we can't do a generalized, this is how you make enriched breads, because there's a lot more variation to enriched breads than there are to lean breads. Regardless of the type of bread that you're making though, I guess as long as it's yeasted, here comes the finesse part. You need to add the rest of your flour, right? But only just enough. So frequently, this is where people get frustrated, because the recipe will say something like 4 to 5 cups of flour. You're like, okay, well, what is it, 4 or 5 cups, right? As a general rule, Right, exactly, because that's a huge difference.
Yeah.
As a general rule of thumb, you need to use as little flour is as necessary. And the reason that recipes tend to give that variance is things like the humidity of your kitchen or this very specific type of flour you're using all affect how dry, how much liquid, how much flour you need, right? So yeah. That's why that is the case. So this is definitely the part where you kind of have to make some judgments. And as you go, you'll learn, okay, I did add a little bit too much flour, a little, not enough or what have you. But what is necessary exactly is dependent on the type of bread you're shooting for. So most of the time you want your dough that is wet but can still be worked with your hands. If it's too wet, you'll struggle kneading it. And if it's too dry, you'll be left with a dry, dense bread, which you won't want to eat. So you'll want to add just like a quarter of a cup or so of flour at a time, mix and evaluate if you need to add more or not. And as you go along, you're just going to figure this out. And as you get better at making bread, the challenge will become to train yourself to be really good at handling dough that's wetter and wetter and wetter. You just have better texture results in your final product, but it does take some getting used to. Handling a wet dough is a challenge. So if you're starting, don't stress yourself out about that. Just know that that's like the level up, right? For breads that are supposed to be mixed really wet, you can do all of the mixing in the stand mixer with the dough hook. It's like, purists would say the cheater way to do it, but it works just fine. I have several recipes that I don't ever touch with my hands. They go in the KitchenAid, get mixed, and I scrape them out into an oil bowl and done. So there's nothing wrong with that. After you've mixed the right amount of flour such that the dough can be worked, you're ready to move on to the kneading stage. And kneading can be done by hand or by a mixer. So if you're doing it by hand, you'll want to be careful not to overflour your work surface. That's another very common mistake. The number one tendency for new bakers is to cover the workstation in flour and to continue to add flour every time the dough gets sticky because it's significantly easier to handle that way. But you're going to do the same exact thing by adding too much flour early on and leave yourself with a dry and dense bread. One trick is to use water or oil on your hands if you're really struggling to keep the dough off. But our best tip is to get a dough scraper and get good at using it. And if you don't have a dough scraper, it's like such a cheap addition to add to your kitchen that you'll find that you use for all sorts of things. We have...
Yeah. It's a good counter scraper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I use it like just to clean up a mess on my counter if I got out of hand while cooking.
Yeah, it's a good scooper.
Right, frequently. So if you don't know what that is, it's just like a metal or plastic blade, essentially. It's not sharp, but... We have the link. I put a link to just a generic one. You pick whatever one you want. I just did one so you know what it is. So to knead the bread then, you'll need to figure out what works best for you. Essentially, you just need to manually beat it up, which is when you beat up the dough, that's how the gluten forms, right? And forms nice, strong scaffolding. So I tip out the dough onto the counter, gather it up into a ball, and then I use the heel of my hand to push the center of it kind of down and away from me at the same time. And then I sort of fold it over and rotate it like 90 degrees and do it again. And when I'm kneading, it's one of those things you don't even think about. Your hands are just kind of doing it. You'll find a rhythm that works well for you. Feel free though, if this doesn't make any sense, again, should be a visual component. Jump up on YouTube and look at some different options because there's people knead in different languages, I swear. There's like different ways.
Yeah.
Everybody's got their own style for kneading. And some, one
it's
way
like
might
a
work
signature.
Best. Yeah. Something may work better for you than others. So there's a couple ways to know then when you're done kneading. And most recipes will say things like smooth and elastic. Great Grandma Mert taught me that this is how it feels when it's done. Both of those are really quite a challenge to show you over an audio platform. They'd even be a challenge to show you in video because honestly.
It's a touch.
Yeah, smooth and elastic. Like, what the hell does that even mean, right? So one thing that really helped my bread game was learning about the gluten window. So you can take a small chunk of your dough and you, like, stretch the dough out between your hands and try and, like, open it up to where you create a window pane. So if the gluten's developed, the dough will stretch but not tear, and you'll be able to pull it so thin that you can see light through it.
Yeah.
And if you try this and it rips... then you know your gluten's not developed and you need to keep kneading. Find a visual component online of that gluten window because it's really cool. And that kind of, once I learned that, I felt like it made it kind of idiot-proof for me anyway. It's like, well, that's like a visual test. You know, you're not just saying if it seems good, right? Most recipes do give you a rough timeline for kneading. And when you're starting out, set a timer or look at the timer, what have you, because it will feel like you've been kneading for 12 minutes and it's been 3 is what happens, because kneading is, if you're doing it by hand, it takes a lot of muscle. It's an old-fashioned method that is so rewarding, but you definitely need stamina to do it. If you're kneading with a machine, you'll want to listen for the slap, slap, slap of the dough. And it's a great sound to know that you have your dough forming well, it's getting worked really well, and you've got your kneader at the right speed. It won't make that slapping noise right off the bat. But if you're not getting it, try turning your mixer up a little bit, and you'll hear it start slapping the side of the bowl. A note on kneading, though, no matter what method you use, the more you knead, the easier the dough will become to handle. So if it starts out too wet, just knead through it, struggle through it. As the dough forms, it's going to hold together better and be less of a mess.
So proving the bread. Proving is what allows the gases to form, push up against the scaffolding of the gluten, and raise the bread. And really, proving is just time. After you have your dough made, you'll want to place it in an oiled bowl. This allows the dough to gain elevation without resistance. And it's important to cover your bowl as well. Plastic wrap works really well. Beeswax wrap, reusable plastic wrap. And what I use is just like, I have this plastic sugar bag. It's plastic, so I was able to wash it out, and then I cut it, and then I use that to proof it because it's just like perfect. So if you can find something to reuse, that's great as well. The idea here is that you just want to prevent the dough from drying out on the edges and forming a skin. A formed skin will create a physical barrier preventing the dough from rising up. And lastly, try and place your dough in a warm place. Although this isn't absolutely necessary, it will just speed things along. And if you can't think of anywhere particularly warm, remember that heat rises, so even a top shelf of a cabinet will be warmer than your counter. I put mine on top of the fridge. And also look to appliances, as they usually produce heat too. And breads typically need 2 provings. The first one rises in its whole form, and the second one rises in its finished form. You will know the first proof is done when the dough has doubled in size. For a lean bread, that can be as quick as 30 to 45 minutes, depending on your conditions. For an enriched dough, you are looking at a couple hours at least. And you can also tell by putting a thumbprint in the dough. If it bounces right back, then you know it still has more rise left to give. If it leaves a deep impression, then it's given all it has to the rise. So after the first rise is done, you'll need to form your bread. Maybe you're going for a round artisanal style bread. That's great. It's basically there after you tip it out of the bowl. Or if you're making baguettes, you're probably going to divide the dough and form them into long loaves. However you need to form the dough, do that now and let it rise again. And this allows it to recover and build back up after being manipulated. This rise is usually significantly shorter. I have the worst time trying to divide it into like thirds or whatever. I guess I'm just bad at division or
no, like guessing the right quantities or whatever.
Yeah. It's an art, I guess. Math. Yeah. I'm not good at it. It's also the time to score your bread too, if applicable. You see all the beautiful trending scoring on IG and TikTok right now. That's a thing. But scoring is more than beauty. It's highly functional as well. So scoring allows gas to expand and escape without bursting the seams. If you don't score, the bread will score naturally on its own, just maybe not where you want it to.
And I guess I didn't, like, poor Tara's just trying to keep up with my chicken scratch here. Scoring, because I just assumed that everybody would know what that is, apparently, is when you take a blade of some sort and do you cut the crust of the dough to make pretty designs in it, typically.
Yeah.
They don't have to be pretty designs, but that's where you'll see like sourdough breads with like beautiful rosemary leaves on them, right? But that's the scoring that we're talking about. On to the actual baking. There's not a ton to know about baking in general. For the most part, you're just going to want to follow your recipes. There are a couple tricks that I've learned though. So if you're going for a crustier bread, you're going to want to introduce steam, which is how bakers do it in the professional world, is with steam injected ovens. Most of us don't have those, to my dismay. I would do some shady shit for a steam-injected oven.
Instead of a Klondike bar.
Right. Yeah. I would do some crazy stuff for it. So the trick, though, if you don't have a steam-injected oven, is to heat up a pan on the lower rack of your oven. And then when you put your bread in, pour a couple cups of hot water into that hot pan underneath and shut the door quickly. Boom. You've got steam. So steam creates a super nice crusty bread.
Oh, that's a secret.
Yes, it's amazing. You can also brush your bread with milk, eggs, or butter to get a softer crust. Those things, depending on which one you're using, can contribute to beautiful browning as well that we see in like rolls and such. Most of the time when it comes to baking bread, you're looking for a hollow sound when you knock on the bread to know when it's done though. Don't knock on your cinnamon rolls. There's some obvious exceptions to this, but that's just like a general rule. And maybe the biggest thing that's overlooked about baking bread is what to do after it comes out of the oven. So you'll probably want to let it sit in its pan for 5 to 10 minutes right out of the oven and allow it to finish setting its structure. This isn't necessarily the case for some bread, say if it's cooked on a flat sheet pan, for example. After though, you're gonna wanna get it out of the pan and immediately put it on a cookie cooling rack or something similar. So don't make the mistake of putting it on a cutting board. It'll just trap the steam underneath of it. And what once was a nice crusty bread will turn soggy on you, and no one wants that. So if I'm making a super crusty bread and I'm adamant about keeping it super crusty, I'll take my like cookie drying rack, cookie cooling rack, maybe it's a better way to say it. And I'll not only just, because if you leave it on the counter, it's got what, like a half an inch of clearance?
Right.
Underneath?
Yeah, it's not very much.
I'll put like 4 mason jars and elevate it all the way. If okay. I'm like really want to keep that bread crusty, and it works wonderful. You just have to have that airflow. Also, please don't store your bread in plastic for like 100 reasons. But it'll do the same thing. It'll just trap the moisture and ruin the texture that you work so hard to encourage. Storing the bread in the fridge does nothing but dry it out. I know so many people store bread in the fridge. So that's the opposite effect, I guess. Bread's really just best stored in a paper bag or craft paper. If you have it on the counter, eat it quickly. So that's another thing too. Now, we talked about other leavening agents, right? There's more to bread than just yeast. And if a lot of people, for some reason, are intimidated by yeasted bread, and I think it's probably just comes down to, you read a recipe on yeasted bread and it says like 6 hours. You're like, what do you mean 6 hours, right? But
yeah,
a lot of that is just letting it sit, you know?
Right, so it's not hands-on time.
Yeah, I'm gonna tell you, if you're intimidated by yeasted bread, you really should just try it, because you're going to have more success with it than you think. But if that is overwhelming, don't push yourself. Start with a different leavening agent and make some bread. So other leavening agents still work to do the same exact thing. They're just a producer of air or gases, and they incorporate that in the dough to be trapped by gluten. It's the same. So baking soda, for example, is a chemical. Sodium bicarbonate to be exact, NaHCO3. And you'll notice that recipes use baking soda also include an acid of some sorts. And it might not be obvious like a vinegar, but did you know milk's acidic as well? Do you know that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of things are acidic, like buttermilk is a very acidic milk, obviously.
That's why they're good for biscuits.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Why? Because they're reacting with the baking powder and raising it. So, yeah. Anyways, yeah, it's great. So we want the extra acid because we want the extra H atom, hydrogen atom, because that reacts with the sodium bicarbonate to produce a few things. But our focus here is CO2. So just think about that volcano experiment from middle school, right? Baking soda and acid. Yeah.
And imagine, I still do it.
Right.
It's so fun. Fun. Yeah.
I do it for cleaning all the time, actually.
Yeah. It works so good in your sinks.
In your sinks. Yeah.
Yes.
For sure.
We're children.
We are children. So this volcano explosion, just imagine that going on inside the structure or micro balloons of gluten and up your bread goes, right? The catch or benefit, depending on how you look at this, is that reaction is happening immediately. So you need to mix and bake, no time in between. It's different than a yeasted bread, which takes time for the raising to occur, because yeast is utilizing live organisms to do that, and they need time to do their work.
Well, the baking soda, like, okay, go back to that experiment. When you're putting the baking soda in your sink and then you're putting the vinegar on, it reaches height really fast. Quickly. So it's the same thing is happening in your bread that's utilizing these two.
It's going so quick.
Yeah. You need to capture that and get it stuck, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And another leavening agent that we've talked about is baking powder. And it works very similar. I didn't necessarily know this. Baking powder, it's just baking soda mixed with cream of tartar or sodium aluminum sulfate, both of which are acids. Did you know that?
No, but now that makes sense, because mine always says aluminum free. So that must use cream of tartar.
Right.
Instead of the sodium aluminum sulfate. Interesting.
You read your packaging a lot, don't you?
I do.
I have no Why? Idea if my baking powder says aluminum free or not.
I try to stay away from aluminum.
When the well, let's not open that can of worms. We don't need to have that discussion right now.
No. I had to send you a video of my maple syrup that says refrigerate after opening. No,
that's what I'm saying. You do a lot of reading. Someone who prides themselves on not reading directions.
I read packaging. I don't have time for directions.
Totally different.
All these packages. Meanwhile, you're reading directions. So yeah. This is how we're different.
Good Lord. Oh my gosh. So baking powder is baking soda with a built-in acid. I had no idea. But you can see where this is going. So with the acid already included, you can be more liberal with what liquid you're using to combine the dough. So you don't have to be as strict on making sure it's acidic or very acidic anyhow. But exactly like baking soda, the reaction is occurring, producing carbon dioxide, which is then trapped in the gluten and raises the bread. Again, though, this reaction is occurring immediately upon adding the liquid. So you'll want to work quickly. Don't overmix it because that'll beat all the air bubbles out too. So another leavening agent that I'll mention is more commonly used in terms of cakes, but it's still interesting nonetheless, is egg whites. And the cool thing about using egg whites as a leavening agent is that there's no magic happening, no chemical reactions, no farting fungi. It's all just manual leavening. So by whipping up the egg whites, they become light and foamy and filled with air. So then you take those whipped egg whites and super gently fold them into the batter, taking care not to pop or deflate the bubbles, obviously, and boom, your air is now inside of the batter, ready to go.
This is how you make Yule logs.
Yeah. Yeah.
With eggs, egg whites.
Genoese cake. Lastly, I'm going to mention this one as well because it's interesting. Steam leavening exists. And this is definitely more important in fancy pastries like puff pastry, which actually uses butter as a raising agent, which you wouldn't think because butter slows down an enriched bread, right? Or like a choux pastry, which is cooked on the stove to reclassify the gluten and then use a steam to rise it. We won't go much into this just because it's not exactly bread, but it's super fascinating nonetheless. Just know it exists if you guys want to dig into it any more than that.
Baking soda bread. If you are at all intimidated by baking bread still after this wonderful tutorial that Steph put together for you, start with a soda bread. The way baking soda works is much more reminiscent of other baking methods that you probably tried and succeeded on. Bust out a couple soda breads and you will enter yeast bread with confidence, which is like half the battle for sure. And there isn't much to go over on soda breads other than following the recipes. Some things like steam in the oven and storing methods are still applicable. But the most fun about the soda bread is that after you've formed it into a ball, it's traditional to score an X across the top to let the devil out, as Irish tradition states. That's really cool. An X,
isn't that cool? Who came up with an X? I don't know. I always say that every time I score. I gotta let the devil out. Yeah, it's like just something that came along at some point.
You know, like baking and making butter, the devil was very really involved. Trying to get his hands in these
very
pastries.
Involved.
Yes. Get out of here, devil.
Hell has got to be bread and butter.
Yeah.
Cut that part out, maybe.
So look up the orange cranberry soda bread recipe. This is great for the first time of year when you can still buy cranberries and oranges are in season and delicious.
Yeah, so good.
So good right now. And we always make soda bread for St. Patrick's Day too. It's a fun tradition to participate in. And soda bread is really just an Irish tradition, not necessarily St. Patrick's Day. But the history behind the connection of soda breads and the Irish is quite interesting if you want to look it up. And don't miss the connection between Native Americans being the first to make this type of bread using soda ash as a leavening agent.
Just so freaking cool.
Right. So much history there.
We were joking about how, like, I think we could do an entire episode on the history of soda ash.
Yeah.
No one would listen to it, but we would love that shit.
We would. We would eat it up.
We would love that.
Yeah, there is so much interesting. The amount of ash being used for things that are so beneficial to how we know to live today is fascinating.
It's insanity, really.
TM, TM, TM. Nobody steal that idea, just in case we want to come back to making that episode.
History of soda. Right. TM, TM. She
says. It's ours.
I'm writing it down.
Yeah, I feel I'm like calling every my lawyer. Episode... so right? We can make sure it's ours.
Our big time.
Yeah.
Lawyer that
doesn't exist.
Doesn't exist.
Right.
Oh my gosh. All right. Well, in that case, everybody turn this off and go make bread. Go watch that show on Netflix. It's really cool.
Yeah. Cooked. And make some bread. Tag us in your bread pictures.
Heck yeah.
So I can be hungry.
Yes.
Happy milking.
Happy milking.
Bye.